Well, hi everyone. I'm Roger Horowitz. I'm the director of the Center for the History of Business, Technology, and Society at the Hagley Library, and I'm happy to welcome you to another episode of Hagley History Hangout, our podcast program that brings attention to some of the really interesting work that draws upon Hagley's research collections. Often we talk to researchers at the early stages of their project. But we also have an opportunity to talk to authors who are done and have published books, such as this one from Vilja Holden. Why is it not reading this? There we go. The Boss's Union, which we can talk more about in a minute. It just came out. Vilja, thank you very much for joining us to talk about your book.
Thanks so much for having me.
Vilja, I should explain, she is teaching associate professor at University of Colorado Boulder. And this has been out for about a year. So, Philly, I hope you don't mind if I'm informal here. That's kind of the way I am in general. Let's start off by telling us why you wrote this book. What motivated you? What was behind it? More about you and your intellectual journey than about the book itself.
Okay. I guess that's always sort of the hardest question. Like, how does anybody ever end up doing exactly the thing that they're doing? So way back in like the very early 2000s, I did a master's thesis on immigration restriction in the United States in the 1920s. And one of the themes that the pro-restriction people were really talking about was that they wanted to limit the number of immigrants because they thought that there were so many labor radicals among those immigrants. And so that got me interested in sort of the labor scene in the around World War I. And not entirely sure how exactly I stumbled upon the National Association of Manufacturers in particular, which became really central in my dissertation, which was 2011. I think that I finished it at the University of Arizona. But having started to think about labor radicals, I started to look at, well, so what did sort of like by analogy of having looked at the restrictionist side of the immigration debate instead of the immigrants, I started looking at the employer side of the labor issue and thinking about, so what exactly were employers thinking about unions and what kind of goals did they have and what did they how did they react to the rise of unionism in the late 19th century and early 20th century? And so that led me to the National Association of Manufacturers. And a focus on their work, and then the book expands on that quite substantially with the National Civic Federation, and then traces back the history of the closed shop of the union membership requirement.
Right. Well, the title, let's just stop with that. The Boss's Union. Who are you talking about, or what are you talking about when you title it the Boss's Union?
So I was playing around with the title for a long time. What I wanted to originally, the working title was "Government by the Bosses," but nobody thought that that was at all like transparent. So that didn't really work. But what I'm trying to get across is the idea of, well, the bosses, the employers, they're perfectly happy to have their own union. The National Association of Manufacturers and various employer organizations, did all kinds of things that they complained very vociferously about when labor unions did them. So they required their members not to deal with unions. And if a member dealt with unions, they often had various kinds of formal or informal ways of punishing that member, which was, of course, like their main complaint about labor unions, their main official complaint about labor unions, that labor unions required workers to join the union. And if a worker refused to join, the union insisted that he not get a job at a particular employer that was unionized. So that's the closed shop, and that's what the employers in the National Association of Manufacturers in particular were particularly against. So what I'm trying to get across with the title Bosses Union is really this idea of who's entitled to self-government, who's entitled to particular kinds of governance over their lives. And what the employers are implicitly saying is, well, of course, employers can do this. It's good and right for employers to organize, and that is it is not only good for employers, but it's good for workers and it's good for the society because business will contribute to a better functioning of the society and so on and so forth, will contribute to good government. Whereas when workers organize, they call that they portray that as something that's not really sort of organically coming from the workers, but something that's imposed on them by these outsiders in the unions.
Exactly. Well, a lot of writers about business in the early 20th century emphasize what's called the collective action problem of how do you compel people to do things and work together there. And so what you're suggesting is that the employers rely upon a certain level of coercion of other firms to solve that problem, much as labor unions had to with workers in their factories and other places.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, employers are by no means exempt from the collective action problem, right? So they, even though in a lot of ways, as Mansur Olson back in the day talked about in the logic of collective action, from I think 1972, employers have some obvious advantages. There's fewer of them. They have more resources. It's more efficacious for them to organize, so it's more motivating. But at the same time, employers do have to work hard at organizing. And so I've got a couple of chapters on why exactly employers manage to organize and what kinds of tactics they use to try to convince employers to join. And just like with labor unions, a big part of, I mean, they do use coercion against other employers, but they also use ideology, like they use exhortation and ideology. And so I think part of why the National Association of Manufacturers, when it takes its anti-labor turn or anti, at least sort of anti-American Federation of Labor turn in 1902, its focus on ending or the progress of unions. When it does that, it really sort of ramps up the rhetoric. It becomes very vociferous and portrays this the problem with unions as a real sort of danger to life as we know it, to American individualism, to freedom, to all kinds of things. And really sort of exhorts employers, uses really stark and sometimes really crude language to make its case to its members. So in a lot of ways, I think the ideology becomes so starkly drawn because it's really hard to get people to actually contribute money and time to this cause, even though like all the employer members, like none of them probably like unions particularly. It's sort of in the nature of an employer not to like a union, but that's a different thing than actually like putting money and time on the line.
Right. So NAM has to articulate an ideology to justify its actions and its existence. Now, in doing so, you stress the importance of the open shop as part of the guiding principles of NAM. One of the phrases, one of the union practices they seize on with their efforts. Explain why that happens. What is the open shop that you're referring to, and why does it operate or place such a central role in this ideology of NAM?
So the National Association of Manufacturers latches on to this idea of the union membership requirement. So it was really standard practice by the late 19th century for craft unions or unions that were composed were occupationally based and composed of skilled workers, such as those that affiliated in the American Federation of Labor. It was really standard practice for them to require that if a particular occupation at a particular employer was unionized, then any worker who took a job there had to join the union. Sometimes there's a pre-hiring closed shop, but a lot of times it's just a requirement that eventually you have to be a union member. And the unions argued that this was an essential part of the whole functioning of a union. First of all, there's the issue of free riders for unions, right? So they have the collective action problem. So they're essentially saying, well, you got to contribute to the union because we are looking out for your interests. But more fundamentally, even the problem for them is, well, if the workers at a particular workplace that the union represents are not union members, how is the union supposed to make a contract with the employer on behalf of those workers? Their whole argument in the late 19th century, early 20th century was that, well, it's desirable for the employer to deal with us because we will provide labor peace. We will provide you with a contract, and if you give us these wages and these working conditions, therefore, then in exchange, we essentially guarantee no strikes during the life of the contract. And of course, how are they going to guarantee that if the workers are not members of the union, they have no way of then controlling those workers. And so that's their argument, that this is just a practical standard thing that is necessary for the union to function. The employers, though, and that practice of requiring union membership didn't really have a name before the NAM invents the closed shop. It's just, a standard part of contracts. And so the NAM then latches onto that as a way to say that unions are infringing on individual rights. Like, why should a worker, in order to work in a workplace, be required to join this organization that, is not, it's not a part of the job, essentially, in the employer's view. In the employer's view, the business is the employer's to run. It is created by the employer, and he should be free to decide who gets to work there. Why should a worker join a sort of third-party organization in order to be employed? And so it allows the employers to portray themselves as the defenders of individual rights and the defenders of workers. And so they coined the term closed shop for the union practice, and then coined the term open shop for what they're representing. And they argue that the open shop is the antithesis of the union shop, in that it allows anybody's welcome as long as they're, willing to work hard. And that it doesn't discriminate on the basis of extraneous matters like union membership. Now, it is, of course, that's of course not true. A lot of employers had blacklists of union members and preferred to hire non-union members. But it allows employers to essentially make the case that we are being fair, whereas the unions are being coercive.
I mean, that's a great description of all that. And one of the things you just said is that this closed shop doesn't exist as a term until the open shop campaign is there. Why does NAM focus on the open shop? Is it strictly because they don't like it with the closed shop, or does it have some sort of strategic value in their effort to recruit other employers to their side, to their campaign?
Well, I think part of it is this rhetorical force of the open shop. It's nice to be for the open whatever, right? Instead of and portray the other side as being sort of closed and closed-minded and exclusionary and so on. But I think more fundamentally, the issue is that the closed shop does give the unions power. It is at the root of the union's power. That's how they grow their membership. That's how they exercise the governance that they believe should be theirs in a workplace. Especially the craft unions come from a tradition where they really think of themselves as heirs to a tradition that is not really about the employer at all. It's really about the craft and preserving the traditions of the craft, and really sort of more of an analog of present-day professional organizations that don't really think about themselves as sort of haggling over wages, but think of themselves as sort of, what the American Historical Association focuses on, what is that historians do and tries to promote the writing and reading and scholarship of history. And so in a lot of ways, the craft unions see themselves in that tradition. And attacking the membership requirement, which is a key to their functioning and to their power, is a way for the employers to really attack the skilled workers' unions. And that is the unions that the National Association of Manufacturers is concerned with. I mean, obviously they don't like the socialists or the radical unions like the Industrial Workers of the World or whatever, but that's not their concern. Their concern is the unions of the skilled workers, because that's who they employ. That's who the manufacturers employ. And that's where the growth is happening in the early 20th century. So they often have quite a bit of experience with skilled workers unions, and they find that they're having a really hard time, sometimes genuinely having a really hard time keeping up any kind of a profit margin when the unions are around, and sometimes sort of just not having quite the profit margin that they would like.
Well, I mean, let's talk about NAM for a minute. I mean, we're talking about NAM right now, but the way you describe the closed shop, open shop issue would suggest that their employers were against it already. Is NAM getting employers to oppose it? Is NAM influencing employer reactions? Are they simply reflecting employer attitudes? How are they shifting, or if at all, employer attitudes towards these craft unions, towards the open and closed shop?
Oh, that's a really good question. They are shifting attitudes. Whether they're, again, like it's hard to imagine many employers who would who really sort of, all things being equal, would prefer a unionized workforce. But by the late 19th century and the turn of the 20th century, there was definitely a real sense of the normalization of unions. And so it, for example, the Stowe founders are a famous case of the National Founders Association are a famous case that by the, I think, 1880s, they, I mean, they've been fighting with the unions, but by the 1880s, they come to the conclusion that it's not worth trying to fight to have to get rid of the unions. Instead, they're trying to sort of improve their negotiating position with the unions and accept the reality that, well, the unions are here to stay. To some extent, that's happening in other skilled labor industries as well as the unions grow. And so there are quite a few employers who sort of take it as part of the territory that, okay, so you got to talk to these unions. The Industrial Commission set up by the President and Congress in 1900, 1901, actually talks about unions as sort of the wave of the future, as a way of putting labor relations, which had been very, very inflamed in the 1880s and 1890s. So we have the Haymarket, and we have the Homestead Strike, and a whole number of really pretty violent labor confrontations. So in that context, there's a lot of sort of middle class opinion and some employer opinion that says, okay, so maybe it's better to have employer organizations and workers organizations, and we can sort of talk about these things civilly and organize this thing, do it in a rational manner instead of fighting over, and having cutthroat competition and so on and so forth. And so in some, especially in some cutthroat industries where labor is a really key part of the expenses of the employer, such as in mining, there's labor unions actually make a lot of headway by being sort of the police that sets a floor under the wages and gets rid of the cutthroat competition in that way. So there is a much, like by 1900, 1901, there is a, it seems like there is a fair amount of acceptance that, well, maybe unions are just going to be part of the landscape. So in that sense, the NAM does galvanize opposition and does probably convince quite a few employers to join in the opposition to unions and to take a really sort of stiff-necked stance of, we're just not going to deal with unions.
How successful is NAM at this point? Talking, I mean, your book goes on over another 20 years, so we're not getting to the end yet. But early 20th century, how significant is NAM in achieving this shift, stiffening, if you will, employer resistance to the kind of craft unions that are quite powerful at that time?
Well, it's really hard, obviously, to give a reliable estimate of the efficacy of any particular movement or organization, but I do think they do make a big difference. So, if you look at what's happening in politics, the AFL has sort of just gotten into political lobbying in the late 1890s, early 1900s, and it's pushing for a couple of things. For example, the end to using injunctions, court injunctions in labor disputes, so having the courts say you can't. During the strike, you can't picket this or you can't do that, and then so on. And it's pushing for an 8-hour day on government contract work. Both of these are reasonably popular in Congress, and they've passed the House a number of times. Especially the 8-hour law has passed the House a number of times, and in 1901, 1902, it's about to pass the Senate as well, or at least there's fears that it might. And so this is like very early in the NAM's anti-union turn. And it's the first thing that they take up in lobbying, and they really make a push to stop it in its tracks. And they manage to do that, like because they map their contracts or contacts the contacts of their members with specific members of the Senate. They manage to stop it from becoming law, and then they manage to do that over and over and over and over and over again until 1912. So for like a 10-year period, they essentially stall labor's progress with regard to national congressional legislation. So in the lobbying scene, they do have a really big impact. Rhetorically, they suddenly, so a lot, as I said, a lot of the sort of tenor of the times in the late 1890s, early 1900s had started to be that, well, maybe unions are just part of modernity. But the focus on the closed shop and the focus that the NAM puts on the various practices that unions do to encourage or coerce workers to join the union. And of course, I mean, it's not, they're not inventing these things out of whole cloth. It's there's certainly instances where strikers would attack strikebreakers, for example. And they really publicize those kinds of things, and they make unions look like thugs, and they make unions look coercive. And that resonates with a lot of middle class observers as well, who are kind of uncomfortable, who don't really understand the logic of the closed shop, who don't really understand that this is part of the union's governance of the workplace and of the craft, and that they really sort of think of this as a way of keeping order. They find it really difficult to understand, well, so in a democratic society, we have this political democracy, and why are these unions supposed to have this power of deciding who gets to work? And so the idea of right to work resonates with people like Ray Stannard Baker, for one. So a number of progressive reformers who otherwise are pretty pro-labor are really uncomfortable with the closed shop. And so that, I think, sort of shuffles the pack and confuses the issue for a lot of people.
So, one app impact we're saying of NAM is within the employers, bringing together employers around this kind of agenda. But you're saying that, in a larger sense, it influences the progressives. This is the progressive era, a lot of efforts at progressive reform, municipal reform, women's suffrage, all that. And you're saying that it helps to keep the progressives from lining up behind the unions that are there in terms of these union tactics of having a closed shop. Is that fair? A name influences the progressive.
Yeah, I mean, I would argue that that is true. So, it's hard to I again it's I think it's hard to sort of say much conclusive about like the NAMs. I don't think many of the progressives are fans of the National Association of Manufacturers, so they don't necessarily see themselves as aligning with the National Association of Manufacturers and or with the employers. But in defending workers, they they're middle class people. They tend to see themselves as the group that knows what's best for the working class, and they tend to see their role as sort of promoting legislation, getting the state to do things, having various kinds of volunteer organizations to help immigrants and workers and so on and so forth. Whereas the closed shop and labor unions are really working class people exercising power without the intervention or the assistance of middle class folks. And because the closed shop is part of what enables labor unions to do that, and because it does seem to middle class people like a coercive practice, they don't really understand, like, why should you be forced to join a particular organization? They're inclined to think of particularly craft unions as sort of a little bit of, I don't know what the best word would be, but a little bit like suspect, I guess,
Right, right.
would be a good word.
I mean, of course, you can't tell what flyer, what statement influenced what person and what time, the context of a larger world there. But you are suggesting that NAM creates a coherent anti-closed shop ideology, which contributes, perhaps, we don't know how much, to this resistance of the progressives, who are the dominant progressive force at that time, to more union power and more authority on the part of unions.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fair to say. Although I also want to emphasize that the progressives are pretty susceptible to that message, sort of given their own concerns and their own sort of preference for maybe state-led or at least sort of middle-class-led kinds of reform.
But well, we can't disentangle that. There's actually no need to, because the result is these limitations on unions. Now, traditionally, it's writing about this period. World War I is a watershed for everything. Wars often are. How does this war and the labor unrest and then the role of the government, how does it influence NAM and this effort to really stigmatize the closed shop?
Well, in some ways, it just doesn't. Like, I think we often think of like we often represent World War One and even more than the 1930s as a moment when so the unions get all this power and then there's an employer reaction, a backlash to that. But at least in the stuff that I was reading, in the documents that I was reading through World War One, it's really they're really just sort of keeping on, keeping on. There's I think no indication during World War One that any of the NAM affiliated employers or employers who are sort of in that overall camp change their minds about unions in any particular way. So during World War One, they're forced to work with the unions because of the sort of quirks of wartime and quirks like the fact that Frank Walsh is in charge of the National Labor the National War Labor Board. And that William Howard Taft is not pushing back against him as much as the employers had expected. So who's the co-chair of that board? So they're forced to work with the unions, but they never like it. They never see it as the new normal. Instead, throughout the war, they're sort of thinking about how are we going to put an end to this when the war is over. And as soon as the war is sort of winding down, and especially once armistice is declared, they just stop cooperating essentially entirely. And they set up so they set up the National Industrial Conference Board during the war, and in the late phases of the war and in the early phases of the peace, the National Industrial Conference Board really focuses on ensuring that the sort of restoration of the open shop regime in the 1920s. So sometimes in some histories of the 1920s, the open shop is represented as something that begins in the 1920s. The open shop movement is represented as something that is as something that comes about in the 1920s as a response to wartime excesses or the rise of labor in the war years. But it's really not. It's a restoration of the sort of status quo antebellum.
Continuity. I mean, this is outside of your book, but I know from my own research that the intervention of the government during wartime is really regulatory, but it doesn't include union recognition. Much of the frustration of the unions in meatpacking and steel, there are improvements, but at no point does the union secure contracts like a bargaining. And that would support your point earlier about the progressives remaining uncomfortable with union power, wanting better conditions, but not wanting to install a union. So what the period you described, the aftermath, unions have a foothold only because of the involvement of the government during World War II. Afterwards, there's no contracts, there's nothing like that to protect them.
Yeah, and even during the war, there's some of the leadership of the National Industrial Conference Board. I forget who exactly, maybe Magnus Alexander or Walter Drew was talking about how, well, maybe in some ways this regime that they're setting up with the War Labor Board is preferable because it doesn't give the unions recognition. So really, like, why what role does it leave the unions in practice if workers aren't getting these rights because of the labor board?
Right. And again, the standard narrative is the government does that because you need to produce for the troops. And once that's over, the government has no interest, in, particularly in staying involved. Whole long story there, folks. A lot of books written about the rail and meatpacking and steel that go in there, but this is kind of the employer reaction. So you're saying what happens in the 20s with NAM is really a continuity with the earliest 20th century continuing on this push to restrict the closed shop and instead emphasize the open shop.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I think it's really clear in the documents that they are not seeing themselves as doing anything new. They're just seeing themselves as keeping it, keeping the faith, keeping the practices of the pre-war era. They do in the 1920s. They do realize that the tenor of the times has changed a little bit, and so there's like personnel management and new philosophies coming in and ideas about sort of prehistory of human resources and things like that, where there's more emphasis on sort of treating your workforce well and having more sort of organized procedures and not having tyrannical foremen and things like that. And so the administrative personnel of the National Association of Manufacturers especially emphasizes those kinds of things and tries to get the employers who are members of the NAM to participate in those kinds of schemes. They don't necessarily have a whole lot of success. There's some of the companies do adopt new kinds of personnel policies, but many of them are really sort of traditional manufacturing companies that are privately held and that do not want a whole lot of bureaucracy and that just really emphasize the power of the owners and the sort of owner manager.
Well, great. Well, you mentioned records. Tell us about the Hagley sources that you found useful for your book.
Well, so I think that the most useful for me were the records of the National Industrial Conference Board from the war years, and then also the National Association of Manufacturers records from the 1920s. So I've been at the Hagley maybe I think 3 times total, and I looked into when I was thinking of this book as going into the 40s and 50s, I did look at a whole lot of other collections as well that the Hagley has that are really strong for that period, the JPU collection and things like that, but I never ended up going that far in the chronology. And the early years of the National Association of Manufacturers in the National Association of Manufacturers records are pretty sparse. So there, the main source is really the records that the Congress subpoenaed as part of a lobby investigation in 1913, and those have been printed into the record, in not the congressional record, but into the congressional hearings records as an appendix. And there's like 10,000 pages of typed, printed documents there. I think those are. I think that it's a great resource, but it's also a very kind of skewed collection because it's really focused on the lobbying. So I think they actually decided explicitly not to put anything in the record that wasn't related to lobbying. So there's a lot that got lost there. But for some reason, there's almost none of that exists in the pre-1920. None of that pre-1920 stuff really exists in the NAM collection at Hagley. But the 1920s records are good. The National Industrial Conference Board records are really good. I did also look at the Chamber of Commerce stuff at some point. I don't think I ended up using all of that, but there, I mean, there's really interesting things there, especially on sort of things where early on I was thinking about this as sort of employers. Employers are often represented as being anti-statist, or businesses often represented as being anti-statist, and I wasn't really convinced by that. It seems to me more that it depends on like what arm of the state and what kinds of state policies. It's a question of. So I was looking into the Chamber of Commerce stuff on things like sort of city governance and being involved in those kinds of things. But it's a really nice archive, and there's some really good stuff in there.
Well, I'm glad you hewed the main part of your story, because certainly my reading literature is that the closed shop doesn't achieve the kind of visibility that it does in your book, as kind of a as a today we call it a wedge issue, but certainly it's not simply a wedge issue. It's also an issue of power. Well, that's great. Well, I mean, do you have any thoughts about a next project, anything like that you want to close with? Something spinning up.
Well, yeah. So my current project is pretty different. It has to do with congressional records, or congressional hearings. So I have a data set that I put together for of all congressional hearings since or between 1877 and 2015, roughly. And so what I'm looking at is who gets represented at congressional hearings. So I've got the metadata. So I've got like for each instance of witness testimony, I've got the witness name and organization and the committee at which they testified and all of that basic information. I've also got the full text. So I've done some work on looking at when labor gets represented at congressional hearings, and I'm thinking of a couple of other case studies to do on the basis
Right.
of these records as well. So
Who has the power?
yeah,
Right.
who gets to, it's called speaking to the state. So who gets to speak to the state, and what do they say when they do?
Oh, that's a great topic. Maybe you'll come back to Hagley since we have, a fair amount of material about speaking to the state as well.
Maybe. Yeah.
Maybe. Well, maybe. Well, Vilya, thank you so much for spending this time with us. Really appreciate it. Again, the book is The Boss's Union: How Employers Organized to Fight Labor Before the New Deal. University of Illinois Press, the leading labor history press in this country. Take a look, and thank you so much.
Thank you. Really good questions.